Welcome to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Asa Winstanley, here as always with producer Tamara Nassar. In August 2024, a group of Palestine Action activists allegedly smashed through the gates of an Elbit weapons factory in Filton, near Bristol, in the west of England. Once inside, they proceeded to do what Palestine Action always did, take direct action to smash up the deadly tools of the Israeli manufacturer on British soil. Several activists were arrested on the spot, and over the following weeks and months, a group of others were hunted down and rounded up. The total number of political prisoners arrested and held on remand after the action has now reached 24. The Filton 24, as they're now known, have become a major focus for campaigners in the UK for freedom of political prisoners for Palestine. Since the group began in 2020, Palestine Action's campaigns have been so successful that they managed to close three Elbit arms factories, in addition to the firm's London headquarters. Earlier this month, one of the Filton 24, Sean Middleborough, absconded from a short conditional release for his brother's wedding and did not return to Wandsworth Prison in London. In an exclusive statement released to the Electronic Intifada, Middleborough said that he had been, quote, held as a political prisoner of Israel in a British prison and was therefore simply being sensible by refusing to return to jail. His current whereabouts remain unknown, but if we count Sean as one of the Filton 24, since he's not truly free until he's formally released, there are currently 29 British political prisoners held on remand pending charges related to Palestine Action. Their detention period has long gone past the standard pre-trial custody limit. In July, Palestine Action was, of course, infamously banned as a quote-unquote terrorist group by Britain's Labour government, which in itself is deeply tied to the pro-Israel lobby. The ban is currently being challenged in Britain's High Court, with the decision on that expected in the new year. But even before the ban, the Filton 24 were being treated like terrorists by the authorities. And since the ban, their conditions of treatment have rapidly eroded and they've been denied basic legal rights. Due to their increasingly desperate situation, six of the political prisoners have resorted to hunger strikes. Two have been hospitalised, and questions about the hunger strikers have been raised in Parliament by your party lawmakers, Zara Sultana and Jeremy Corbyn, who both wrote to Justice Minister David Lammy in recent weeks. To discuss all this, we've got two special guests on the show today. Francesca Nadine is a former Palestine Action political prisoner herself, and is now a campaigner for prisoners' rights. She's a spokesperson for the group Prisoners for Palestine. Shamina Alam is the sister of Cameron Ahmed, who is one of the Filton 24 and is currently on hunger strike. Welcome to the show, both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Hiya, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting us today.
Great to be having you on the show. Francesca, of course, I want to talk about the hunger strikers, but first, let's set the scene a bit. You yourself are a former political prisoner who was previously held on remand in relation to allegations stemming from a successful Palestine Action campaign against Barclays Bank, I believe. You also had been held on remand until you were finally released on bail in March this year, I understand, and your trial is expected to take place in January, is that right?
So I can see here that you very kindly put up the article that Electronic Intifada published from me while I was in prison. So that was the first article I ever got published in my life. Very special moment for me. So I was remanded, yes, after a Barclays action, but the trial that I had already this year in May was for an action at a factory called Teledyne, an American arms company that makes parts for the F-35 fighter jet that's used in Israel, amongst other things. But it was after this Barclays action that I got remanded, and that's the trial that I have in 2027, yes. So I've been punished twice over already for the first action, and I'm still waiting for my punishment for the second one.
So the Barclays trial, did you say 2027? So it's not for another year? A year and a month.
I think that's quite, yeah, sorry. That's quite normal, unfortunately, the way that things are at the moment. The court system, the so-called justice system is an absolute shambles. And there's many, many people that have to wait years for their trials. And the film 24 and the Bride's Not on 5 are just one example of that.
So as you said there, you wrote those two articles for the Electronic Intifada while you were in jail, letters from a political prisoner. You wrote those from before Palestine Action was banned. But even before the so-called terrorist ban, could you tell us what your treatment was like? I mean, you know firsthand what the British prison system is like, and you know firsthand what it's like to be treated as a prisoner associated with Palestine Action. Talk about your experience a bit.
Well, of course, the sentencing, the treatment of protesters has been deteriorating for many years in this country. They've become more and more draconian, and that goes for climate protesters as well as pro-Palestine protesters. So being held on remand for such a long period of time without a conviction, when I was obviously no risk to the public, was completely unjustified. And of course, when you go to prison, it's a really grim place for everybody. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It's just a place that's designed to break people's spirit. And there's, you know, people survive it in different ways. Unfortunately for me, I'm very outspoken. And because of my political opinions, which I quite openly expressed towards the prison staff, that meant that I had special treatment. But I always wore it as a badge of honour. If I was getting punished by them, it meant I was doing something right. But I got lucky, that's the truth, because this was before the time that people were accused of terrorism. So I was accused of the same thing as the Filton 24s, the Bride's Knot and 5, which is property damage. But just by pure luck, I got sent to prison a few months before this word started getting used. So I remember it really well when I was in my prison cell getting the news of first it was the Filton 6, then it was the Filton 18, then it was the Filton 24, and the numbers just kept going up and up. And I couldn't believe it. It was really just unexpected, the scale of it. You know, I had an idea that something like this might be coming. There were indications from the government, for example, from Lord Walney, who was recommending this kind of thing beforehand.
That's John. What still, John
when
Woodcock.
The reality hits you. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, just for viewers and listeners, so-called Lord Walney is John Woodcock, the disgraced former Labour MP, who's somehow touted by the mainstream media as some sort of expert on terrorism, when really he is one of the country's most notable pro-Israel lobbyists.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for that context. So yes, all of a sudden there were lots of people in prison and I had lots of people to write letters to. So I felt like I got to know a lot of my comrades in prison without ever actually meeting them. So when I got out of prison, it was an opportunity for me to continue supporting them from the outside. And that's what I've strived to do in any way possible. And will continue to do, obviously.
Well, Shamina, I want to come on to you in a minute, of course, to talk about Cameron. But maybe before I do that, I could ask Francesca, ask you to set the scene, the context for the what's happening at the moment in the country in terms of the political prisoners and the hunger strikes. You are, Francesca, you're a spokesperson for a group called Prisoners for Palestine, which is, I believe is a fairly new group working to support the political prisoners. Tell us about the work of your group and what is happening at the moment with the hunger strikers. How many people are on hunger strike? How long have they been on hunger strike? And is it difficult to get media attention?
So there was a real feeling that I got from some of the letters from some of the people in prison, a frustration of the fact that when you're locked up in a tiny prison cell and you see a genocide continuing, you're not able to do anything to prevent that. So this frustration culminated is, you know, starting these conversations and this collective in order to continue organizing collective resistance, even from inside the prison cell. And there's lots of different ways to do this. And of course, a hunger strike is the most drastic form of resistance that can take place in a prison cell. It's but when the hunger strikers told us that they wanted to do that, of course, we told them that we would support them all the way. And that's what we're here to do now, to amplify their voices, to support their demands, to make sure that they're met. And this started on the 2nd of November on the commemoration of Balfour Day, of course, a very important day over here.
So that's nearly a month as we're filming this now. That's nearly almost a month ago. So they've been they've been on hunger strike for almost a month now, some of them.
Exactly. So as you can imagine, and as Sharmina will explain, their health is deteriorating now in quite a serious way, despite that the government is still failing to engage with the process of negotiations, with the demands. We have sent letters to the Home Office, because, of course, it's the Home Office that are responsible for giving these demands, because it's the Home Office that are behind this whole witch hunt of the people in prison and of a wider movement of pro-Palestinian protest in this country. So there are five demands. They're all very reasonable and things that would be granted in any so-called democracy, but it's not happening here. And that's why the people on hunger strike feel that they have no other choice but to take this action, because all other legal avenues have failed.
Right. So tell us the five demands.
So the first one, and this is directed at the general public, and for the prisoners, it's the most important one, that is to shut Elbit down. So everybody that can continue taking action on the prisoners' behalf to shut down these factories in this country on their behalf, because now they're in prison, they can't do that. The next demand is no censorship in prison. So there's been an extreme level of censorship as a result of the political opinions and actions of the prisoners, as a result of this terrorist designation with no justification, with no evidence. The third demand is immediate bail. So as you mentioned, most of the people in prison have been held over the 6 months time limit. They don't meet the conditions to be remanded in the first place, and they don't know when they'll be sentenced or if even they'll be found guilty. Number four is the right to a fair trial. So obviously this is not happening because there's been constant lies and slander by government ministers, by the mainstream media. And as we know from the great reports by Declassified, there's lots of undisclosed meetings that have been going on with Elbit Systems, different British state actors and the Israeli lobby as well, in which they specifically mention Palestine action and remanding people who've taken action. Demand number five is deprescribe. So there's a huge campaign around this at the moment, obviously. Lots of people getting arrested in the street for holding up signs. And alongside that, drop the terror link that is being put on these cases, again, without any justification or any evidence. And I know you asked me the question earlier and I forgot to actually answer this part about the media coverage. So we're seeing that there's almost a complete blackout in the mainstream media about this story. And this is a very significant story in many senses. So we have to ask ourselves a question. Why is this story being blocked? Why do we get these conversations with a lot of different journalists saying that for some reason it's being blocked by their bosses? It seems very suspicious to me.
So you have had conversations with mainstream journalists about this, and then the stories have not actually transpired. Is that what you're telling me?
That's exactly right, yeah. On various occasions, I can see a pattern emerging here where it gets blocked by editors or lawyers. So, you know, there are suspicions around that. We'll see how that continues. But obviously, you know, that there are a lot of interests here by the establishment in this story not becoming widespread news, because then there will be public pressure to grant these demands. There will be widespread public support, and they can't allow that to happen, because that will be a loss for Elbit Systems.
Can you name any of those outlets?
I'm not sure if I'll get in trouble for this, but yeah.
It's okay.
I can talk about the BBC. And I think everybody can talk about the BBC. It's very well known that throughout this genocide, they have had extremely biased coverage. They have been actively involved in this media cover-up. They are a propaganda tool of the British state, which is a very close ally of Israel. So it's obvious, isn't it, what's happening here? They'll do anything they can to silence any story that has to do with people fighting for Palestinian liberation.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I don't have the story in front of me, but earlier today, I believe, or certainly over the weekend, a story came out in the Grey Zone, the UK Grey Zone, by Kit Clarenberg and an Australian journalist called William Evans, I believe, about the D-Notice Committee, or the DSMA Notice Committee, which reveals for our international, for our non-British viewers and for many British viewers and listeners as well who might not know, the D-Notice Committee is essentially a system of essentially military censorship. Thank you, Tamara. Yeah, this is it on screen here. Files expose Britain's secret D-Notice censorship regime. It's essentially a system of military censorship of the British media where it's a supposedly voluntary system, but it wields a great degree of influence over the British media of what can and can't be broadcast in or printed in the British media. And some files came out through the Australian government really showing the extent of this. I believe the files date from before Palestine Action, but nonetheless, it shows some of the topics that were censored in there include, you know, British special forces involvement in Syria and so on and so forth, things like that. There's some really alarming stuff in that story. So, you know, it would not surprise me to find out if there have been in the future, we'll more than likely probably find out, then there may well have been similar D-notices imposed on Palestine Action coverage by the British media. I wouldn't be surprised. So I am alarmed, but not entirely surprised to hear you say that. But nonetheless, you know, we hope for an improvement. Let's talk about a concrete example then of the hunger strikers. Shamina, your brother Cameron is one of the Filton 24 political prisoners and is currently on hunger strike. So talk about his case, if you would. I mean, you know, you may be restricted in some of the things you can talk about, but, you know, whatever you feel like talk about his arrest, talk about, you know, how he's being treated right now and talk about his current condition. Just before we started filming, actually, we heard from him over the phone very briefly. You know, it was very clear, you know, from he was very appreciative to be able to get any kind of media coverage, and you know, he sent his best wishes to us, which was greatly appreciated. And you know, we send back, I'm sure there'll be many, many viewers and listeners who will send their solidarity to him. And you know, it was quite striking how, you know, he seemed to feel very affected by what is happening to him, you know, the physical effects of the hunger strike. You know, how long has he been on hunger strike now?
Today is day 22, which me and my family keep talking about how insane that feels, like to be without food for 22 days. I could barely cope without food for half a day. Like when Muslims, we fast, and like, even to do like half a day of fasting, by the end of it, you're wanting to eat, you're wanting to break your fast. And for him, he's like on an open-ended fast that's going on forever with no end sight at the moment. To say it out loud, even for him earlier when we were talking about it, he was like, has it been 3 weeks? Because time is just, I think it's slower. It's been slower since these guys have been on hunger strike. You feel every minute.
And it seems like you're regularly in contact with him How is he doing? How is he in high spirits? Is he optimistic? What is the feeling from inside right now?
I think it's a bit mixed. I will say one thing like that defines Cameron's character, and I would say for all of the hunger strikers, is they're so strong, like strong in their mind. They know what they want, and they know that these demands, they're not anything that they're asking which is eccentric or extra. These are all things the government should have been doing, essentially, not just for them, for the British public, but they haven't been met. And so now they're using their bodies and putting it on the line to have these demands met. And because they believe so strongly in getting those and the autonomy of their body, it's powering them through. So whenever I hear Cameron talk about how he's feeling, every single time he sounds upbeat. It's like he's the one trying to keep me happy. And I'm like, how are you doing that? You're the one with no food. But it's how he's always been. He's very determined to make sure that these demands are heard and things are gone out publicly. And it's all part of, at the end of the day, he's currently doing remand because of his commitment to the liberation of Palestine. And this is just another commitment he's making for the liberation of Palestine. During the march on Saturday, I had someone come up to me with a message from some Palestinians on the West Bank.
Was this in London, the solidarity yeah. demonstration, the National March in London? Yeah,
yeah, that's correct. And someone came up to me. I won't give the names of the Palestinians because I don't want to put them at risk. But she came up to me and told me about these individuals in the West Bank who heard about Cameron doing hunger strike, and they got really emotional and were grateful. Yeah, and they wanted me to send a message to Cameron specifically, and saying that they're so grateful for his solidarity and what he's doing. I had also another Palestinian. They call him the hummus guy. I'm going to have to remember his full name, but I remember him as the hummus guy. He's quite, he does his rounds on social media. And he said something about the experience of what Cameron and the political prisoners at the moment are going through mirrors some of what the Palestinians are going through, from the hunger strike to the imprisonment to the like censorship, all of these things where they're doing an uphill battle to get their freedom. It's closely mirrors it. It's not exact, but it mirrors it. And it's like they're living the experience of a Palestinian, and they don't have to. This is the option, right? In this country, we don't have to do those things, but they choose to, because how are you supposed to be liberated when there is somewhere across the world a group of human beings that are being killed and being denied the liberation that we can so freely do? But yes, Cameron was arrested last year on the 19th of November. And he was part of the 8 that then increased from the Filton 10 to the Filton 18. And then since then, I don't know if it's been widely reported. I think some people know about it, but Cameron did get bail. He was one of the first Filton, at the time Filton 18, to be granted bail on the basis of looking after my parents, on the basis that the judges felt that there was enough stipulations to stop any chances of reoffending or risk of reoffending. And he was granted that. But within that same space of the judge putting her mallet down and saying, you've got bail, the CPS had their hands up so fast. And they appealed. They appealed the judgment. And we went to the Royal Courts of Justice, which wasn't so just. It was interesting.
So they appealed to the High Court?
Yeah, so they appealed the decision. So it got taken to High Court because that's where the appeals are heard. It was interesting because a judge asked Cameron to come down to the court. So he, at that time, was at Thameside, a prison which he was getting on fairly well with. He wasn't having too much difficulties there. But the judge brought him to the High Court. He wasn't able to hear the first half because, as many people know, if you had any involvement with prisoners and trials, the prisoners never come on time because the vans are incapable of bringing the prisoners on time. So he actually missed half of his bail appeal. And the other half that he heard was the judge basically talking to him like he was guilty. So when Cams reflects upon this, it's like they've made the decision of what I am, but actually I'm a remand prisoner. And I always thought the UK justice system was innocent until proven guilty. Mm. But in this case, as we have seen with the Filton 24 and a lot of the activists that are now in prison, they get treated like they're guilty before their trial. And so all of a sudden they're doing sentences before the actual trial. So it doesn't matter whether they get acquitted or they get found not guilty or they get sentenced. They've already done a sentence. They've done like a prison time already. That at the appeal, his bail was then denied, despite our barrister actually putting in more stipulations to make his bail conditions more stricter. So to appeal to the judge, but it got denied. And that sort of glimmer of hope that he would be out up until his trial was taken away from us. And his trial is now set for June 2026. So that's almost, I think, 18 months since he first got arrested,
wow,
which is wild. So he's been in prison for a year and a half. That's an actual sentence.
So by the time of his trial in June, or by the time that his trial is currently scheduled in June next year, he will have, unless somehow he's, you know, granted bail between now and then, you know, he will have been imprisoned on remand for 18 months. And that's astonishing when you put it that way.
Yeah. And I think we have to look at the basis of what happened with those. In fact, he got bail and then it got appealed. And then what was interesting was the judge that granted him the bail all of a sudden was taken off from the rest of the trials for the Filton 24. So she was the original judge to basically set up the trials, so to get everything ready and in order before the judge that was actually going to be sitting on the trial was going to take place. But she was taken off. And that happened straight after Cams's bail verdict. So that was
This was in a Crown Court.
Yes, this was in Crown Court. Yeah. This is at the Old Bailey. Mm. And she's a very well-respected judge. So to overturn her decision, it's not something that would be done lightly.
What's her name?
Justice Chima Grubbs.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, I mean, there's a variety of factors, I think, with all of this. Like when you mention about the inability of the prison service to bring Cameron even on time to his hearing, there's a wider institutional problem here with the British so-called justice system. Britain has a system of decaying Victorian prisons, and, you know, successive governments have underinvested in the justice system to the extent that, you know, even what would be called in America public defenders, you know, or legal aid in this country, are no longer as widely available as they used to be for many people. But also, I think what we're definitely seeing with the Palestine Action connected prisoners is an establishment stitch up. You know, like, I mean, what you mentioned there about the judge who granted Cameron bail is really fascinating. I hadn't known that. And we have, you know, she's been taken therefore off all the other cases. I mean, we perhaps don't have time to get into the full thing today, but even with the case that Huda Amouri, the co-founder of Palestine Action, is taking against the government to unban Palestine Action, we've seen that hearing, which as we're filming this, began last week, and is the 3-day hearing is due to conclude tomorrow, the second of December. With that as well, I mean, I wrote a story about how, and as others as well have covered it, about how the judge on that case was taken off the case at the last minute and replaced by a panel of three judges, two of whom are certainly close to the British establishment, we could say, and at least one of whom is, certainly has links to the pro-Israel lobby. So we're seeing a bit of we're seeing the British state put out all of its power to stop Palestine action and to punish activists who have taken direct action against an Israeli arms manufacturer, Elbit Systems, which provides is the largest private Israeli arms manufacturer. It provides 80% of Israel's drone fleet, and it is components built and assembled in this country are then being used to carry out a genocide in the Gaza Strip. So, you know, this is what has really motivated the campaigners. But you've talked about and put this a little. Shamina, put this in a little bit more context. Mm. You know, he's been on remand for more than a year now. And as you said, by the time of his trial in June, he will have been on remand for a year and a half. What is he actually charged with?
So currently the charges stand as criminal damage and violent disorder and aggravated burglary. Those are the three charges.
Yeah, so you know, there's, you can see how this is a political. It's absolutely a political case. He's a political prisoner because these are things that normally, as was mentioned by Francesca, that you know someone would normally be on remand for such an allegation. Someone would not normally be on remand this long and would have been granted bail. And as you said, he was actually granted bail, but it was then appealed. So how has he been treated, Shamina? How has he actually been treated inside prison? How you mentioned the first prison he was in was not so bad, perhaps. How is it going for him inside right now?
So when he got, after the appeal hearing for his bail, he got moved to Pentonville, and so he has been in Pentonville since then. His initial move to Pentonville, the buffer period whilst he got there was really difficult. He came over whilst he was fasting, and one of the incidents that took place was they weren't going to give him dinner because he'd bypassed the time of dinner, like dinner was given an hour ago. But he was fasting and he was explaining to them, I've been fasting and I've been in court. I need to have food, otherwise I'm going to pass out. Other prisoners basically created a fuss, and then he was able to get some food. And then they stuck him in a 30-degree heat cell. And if anyone remembers that February, it was hot. So it was hot in its cell, it was hot outside. And he became extremely dehydrated. That went on for about a week. And only because I didn't hear from him for 5 days, I put in a welfare check because I was really concerned. From the welfare check, we then found out that basically he doesn't have access to a phone at the moment because the phone is broken, which he had reported and told them that it was broken. He'd also reported about the heating being an issue, but they hadn't listened. At this point, he was near like breaking point. He was really upset on the phone, but couldn't talk long because they said it was only for like two minute call to your family. After that, I felt like if I didn't say something, he would have been kept in that cell for longer, because literally the day after, or I think, so that happened on like a Friday, Saturday, Monday, he was moved to another cell. All of a sudden, he's got access to a phone. And that particular story shows the importance of advocacy outside, advocacy from family, from loved ones, from the public. And that's why the hunger strike, I know we're going to go into it a little bit later, but the hunger strike only works with the work and advocacy outside. If we want our loved ones to succeed in getting their voices heard, the people out here have to be their voices. They have to be loud and proud, and they have to bring it to the streets. His change then to the new cell really helps him like readjust, but he struggled a little bit with prison politics, which I'm sure Francesca is very aware of. And then since then, he's like, not all guards are nice, but he's been able to get by. He's built relationships with the external workers that come to the prison. But what's coming out is that despite him developing, let's say, better relationships with some of the prison guards and officers, as he's gone on this hunger strike, he knew that animosity would build up. And so he's having more negative experiences inside prison. There was incidences of when he first was there, they would do lockdowns a lot. So he wouldn't get time outside. And when his MP intervened, the governor of the prison basically came and had a go at Cameron and said that he was making everything up and tried to intimidate him, which is insane because Cameron was like, actually, I've got it all listed here and I've been making note on the days. That was quite difficult for Cameron because he felt like they were trying to goad him into an argument or something for him to react so that they can then punish him. He was able to keep his cool. But Pentonville, because they are a failing prison, and because the Minister of Justice at the time had inquired about why are these prisoners not getting enough time out, suddenly got their back up. And so we're going to see this repeating again with the hunger strike as more publicity is shown on Pentonville, because they know they are a failing prison. The governor is going to try and suppress news about this as much as possible and is going to try and not engage with them as much as possible. And we saw this when Cameron was recently hospitalized. The governor made sure that we were not allowed any communication with Cameron. And that's not even to like speak to him on the phone. They decided not to give us any updates on his health, on what he's being treated for and how he is in the hospital. And also then denied this with his solicitor. So his solicitor, towards the end of his hospitalization, wasn't able to get any updates on him. So we can see that there's like a systematic attack to silence these prisoners and keep what they're going through as hidden as possible. But you wouldn't need to hide something if it wasn't unjust. See what I mean?
Yeah. So last week, as you mentioned there, it was reported that Cameron was hospitalized because of the effects of the hunger strike on his body. Is he still in hospital and how is his current health doing this week?
So he was discharged. He was admitted on Tuesday the 25th and then discharged the following Friday. And to be honest, currently his health is not doing amazing. He's really tired. He's finding evenings very difficult. He tends to fall asleep. So around this time, so yesterday he didn't call me in the evening. He's just finding it really hard to stay up. He's finding it really difficult to breathe. And then earlier today, he's noticed that his sugars are dropping again and his ketone levels are rising, which he feels like will indicate that he'll probably need to go back to hospital soon if those ketone levels don't stabilize. When he went into hospital, they basically found that he had acidic blood, which obviously is not good for the body. And they noticed that he had arrhythmias in his ECG. The arrhythmias, he's never had them before. So it's not like it's a genetic condition that he has. It's obviously developed from the hunger strike. And now he's getting difficulty breathing. So as you can see, his organs are really struggling to keep up with the demands on his body without food. With his time in the hospital, he said it was the most inhumane and degrading experience of his life. And actually, he wanted to be discharged because he could not handle being there anymore. When he got into the hospital, they made him wear hospital garments, despite the fact that other patients on the ward are in their normal clothes. They then took away his shoes and he was not allowed to have any form of footwear. This meant that he would have to go to the toilet with bare feet, but the nurses on the ward were kind enough to provide him with two pairs of socks, so he was able to wear socks at least to the toilet. This ward was mainly filled with geriatric patients, like really elderly patients that have incontinence issues. So you can imagine the toilet wasn't the cleanest place. So then to be just going in socks is not nice. he talks about the experience of when he had to shower. The guard, because he has to stay cuffed to a guard at all times, the guard stands outside the door. He was holding Cameron's clothes and then just basically threw them on the floor. And the clothes got wet and there was brown stains on the floor. And so he asked the guard, would you wear that? What you've just dropped on the floor, you're expecting me to wear that now. Would you wear it? And he had nothing to say and he's like, no, the water's clean. And Cameron felt, it's horrible. Like, you're now having to wear these clothes that you're picking up off the toilet floor. After that, on Thursday, they decided to put him, as to make him seem even more alien to the ward, they put him in an escape suit. And when he was discharged on Friday, they didn't give his shoes back. So he had to leave the hospital and return to the prison without shoes. He walked bare feet back to prison. And I'm just like, is that what's happening in the UK? That you can't even give him his shoes so he can walk back? And he said that the experience basically alienates you from the other people that are on the ward because no one wants to talk to you. They just think you're a mad person or you're cuffed and you look like you're not someone that should be spoken to. Other things that happened was just like the doctors would only talk to the guards. He felt like they were ignoring him. He asked for his notes, summary of all of his medical notes from this admission. And the doctor turned around and asked the guard if that was okay. And the guard said no. And then Cameron was like, but it's my medical notes. It's about me. You don't need his permission to access my data. You need my permission. And they still refused to give him his medical notes, which was really interesting because you can see, like, we talk about censorship, right? But who thought your medical notes would get censored? It's literally about your body.
It's really interesting, Shamina, because you talked earlier about the Palestinians who approached you in London to talk about the similarities with what Palestinians go through. And we know that the hunger strike has, for the whole of the Palestinian struggle, the hunger strike for Palestinian prisoners has been a tactic and a strategy of resistance for Palestinians. And, you know, we talk a lot in recent years about, or we have at the Electronic Intifada anyway, we have talked about essentially the Israelification of the West in a lot of ways, in America, in the UK, the Israelification of a lot of institutions, and which, you know, it sounds from what you're saying, we're hearing, you know, the use of secret evidence, for example, you know, they do that, the Israelis do that. We're seeing that being used in, again, the Palestine Action ban overturn. There is going to be secret evidence used there. The abuse and neglect of prisoners, as you've mentioned, and especially vindictive punishments that you've mentioned, you know, a lot of it will have resonance for a lot of our listeners and viewers who are familiar with the details of how the Israelis treat Palestinian prisoners. Although, thankfully, the most extreme circumstances perhaps we're not quite there yet, but nonetheless, it's very concerning to hear about all of this. Francesca, the other hunger striker who's been hospitalized recently is T. Hoxha, who's been on remand since November of last year. And earlier this month, she wrote a letter from inside prison, which we published at the Electronic Intifada. And in it, she talked about a previous hunger strike she'd embarked on and described how the conditions of the prisoners have deteriorated since the so-called terrorist ban on Palestine Action. And she wrote, quote, "We have been removed from and refused jobs, called terrorists, harassed by guards, had social visits cancelled, had our mail blocked, and I had to go on a 28-day hunger strike to get my basic needs met. Our bail applications have been continuously denied and my male co-defendants are being held in filthy, depressing conditions." She's now, again, once again, on hunger strike, joining some of the other prisoners at the moment on on hunger strike. How many prisoners are on hunger strike at the moment? Is it six? Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's correct. There's six people on hunger strike, on full hunger strike, but there's also one person, our comrade Louis, who's on a partial hunger strike. So that's he's fasting once every 2 days. And that's because he's actually diabetic. So despite the fact that he's eating every other day, it's still incredibly dangerous for his health. But he's so determined, just like the other hunger strikers, to stand by their side in this moment to fight for justice, for their demands, that he continues to do it against the actual medical advice. I also would like to mention our comrade Uma, who from his prison cell just a few days ago was the first person, so very original, to do a Defend Our Juries action from inside a prison cell. So he made a statement that got put out afterwards using the phrase that the Defend Our Juries people put on their placards, which is supporting a terrorist organization. And he just added at the end to the counter-terror police, "You know where I am, come and get me, I'm waiting for you." So that's the courage that we can see from all of the people right now in prison. And that's a rallying cry, a real example for people to follow. And that's why they're receiving so many solidarity actions around the world, that people are so moved and inspired by what they're doing.
So for context, Defend Our Juries is an organization which has been campaigning against, well, they've been going for a little while, and then they've actually been campaigning to defend juries, and it predates actually Palestine, the issue of the ban of Palestine action, because there are wider issues of juries in Britain being allowed to acquit according to conscience. And actually, we've seen moves announced this past week by the so-called Justice Minister, David Lammy, again, in hock to the Israel lobby. He's definitely a very pro-Israel minister who has actually been financed by pro-Israel lobbyists. But he has actually announced that effectively the end of trial by jury, except for the most serious cases in the UK. So, you know, this is a real ongoing problem with the justice system in Britain. But Defend Our Juries has been campaigning against that, and they've been campaigning more specifically against the ban on Palestine action. And what you're referring to there is there's been civil disobedience against the ban on Palestine action over the last few months since the ban on Palestine action came into effect. And Defend Our Juries volunteers have been holding public gatherings where they deliberately hold signs that read, "I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action," and challenging authorities to arrest them. And I believe 2,000 of them, I think that's, is that correct? Around about that amount of people have been arrested.
About 2,500. Right. And it's going up every day because more and more people are going out to get arrested, actually.
Yeah, so it's kind of a kind of mass civil disobedience. And there has been mixed results, actually, in some areas. Some police in some areas have had a more lenient attitude towards it. But there's certainly a lot of political pressure for them to be put away, it seems. And none of those cases have come to trial yet. But we'll see how that goes. But give us an update, if you can, if you know anything about T's current situation and condition and how she's being treated.
Yes, so as you mentioned, she was hospitalised over the weekend, last weekend. She's now being discharged, as far as I know. So I think a very similar situation health-wise as all the other hunger strikers. Now, after such a long period of time without food, they're all very weak, dizzy. They struggle to think clearly, make decisions, or, you know, their memories declined a lot as well. They've lost a lot of weight. One of the other people on hunger strike, Amu, has now lost 10 kilos. That was the last update that I had. So it's reaching a critical point now in everybody's health who's on the hunger strike. So for that same reason, a critical point in this campaign. And the urgency is really there to do everything we can to support these demands, to support the hunger strikers, and to get the demands that they're asking for.
Well, finally, if you could tell us, Francesca, about where our viewers and listeners can go to learn about more about these campaigns, to keep up to date with what is happening with the hunger strikers and the political prisoners, and what they can do to support them and their release.
Yes, so we have a website, prisonersforpalestine.org. We're also on social media, Instagram, Twitter. I believe there's a TikTok now as well. So there is a page on the website that tells people lots of different ways to support. I think the key thing right now is visibility. So like I said, we've had this mainstream media blackout. We will keep pushing that in any way we can, because that is sadly the way that most people find out what's going on in the world. So we have to make our own visibility. We're asking everybody in whatever way they can to make it known to the world what is going on, and that these people are hunger striking for justice, for their own justice and for the Palestinian people. And alongside that visibility, the public pressure grows on the British state to fulfill their demands. So this is what we're asking for. Just get out there and tell everybody about the hunger strikers, and take a look at our website for more specific ways to help.
That's prisonersforpalestine.org. Thank you very much. Shamina, do you have any final thoughts or message?
Right now, the lives of our loved ones, especially the hunger strikers, is in the hands of the government. And the government can either choose to repeat 1981, or they can choose to be different and finally rise up and actually take accountability for their actions and support in this genocide, and finally put their British citizens first rather than the Israeli lobby.
Thank you. Well, by referring to 1981 there, of course, you're referring to the hunger strikers in the north of Ireland, and most famously led by the Irish Republican prisoner Bobby Sands, who actually died under a hunger strike during the government of Margaret Thatcher in the Mays prison in the north of Ireland. So we thank you both of us. We thank both of you today for joining us and for sharing, you know, your experience with us, and for keeping us up to date with all of this. And as was said, you know, viewers and listeners, you can keep up to date with all the developments at prisonersforpalestine.org, and we will be closely following events here at the Electronic Intifada. So thank you both today. Thank you.